Good evening, everyone. My name is Kendall Crolius, and I'm one of the many volunteers from Reading Odyssey and the Darwin 150 Project who are producing this program. I'm in just a moment going to give a brief introduction for our speaker, Jonathan Weiner, who will speak for approximately 40 minutes, and we will then open this up to questions and answers from the audience here at Columbia and around the world. I am absolutely thrilled to welcome Jonathan Weiner to be our speaker tonight. Jonathan is an award-winning author who has a really special and unique gift for making science accessible to general audiences. And as an English major, I appreciate that more than I can tell you.
His books have won countless awards, and his book, The Beak of the Finch, I hope he's going to sign my copy tonight,
won the Pulitzer Prize.
Jonathan is a professor in the Graduate School of Journalism here at Columbia University. We are honored to have him give this lecture. Please join me in welcoming Jonathan Weiner.
Thank you very much, Kendall, and many thanks to you, Phil. Phil Terry and I have had many talks on the telephone, and this is the first time we've met this evening. I'm sorry. To the audience, I appreciate your moving three floors and staying with us. I'm sorry for the confusion there over the lecture hall. Those of you listening in haven't had to move around. I'm very glad that you're tuning in and listening. Thank you. It's an honor to be part of the Darwin 150 Project. It's a thrill to be able to participate in celebrations around the world of Darwin's 200th birthday and the 150th anniversary of the Origin of Species. I just wanted to add that if people are listening at Texas A&M and at Arizona State, I have friends there from visits some time back, and so I'll say hi. I'll tell you, when I started working on a book about evolution, I knew so little about the subject that I didn't even realize it was controversial. And I always like to start by saying that because I've been continuously surprised, given the nature of the project that brought me to the writing of a book about evolution, that it should be controversial, because I was looking over the shoulders of two extraordinary biologists at Princeton, Peter and Rosemary Grant, who watch evolution happen, watch evolution in action in Darwin's Islands with Darwin's finches. Darwin himself didn't think that you could do that. Darwin thought that evolution proceeds far too slowly for anybody to watch. And he says in a famous passage in The Origin, "It may metaphorically be said that natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing throughout the world the slightest variations, rejecting those that are bad, preserving and adding up all that are good, silently and insensibly working whenever and wherever opportunity offers. We see nothing of these slow changes in progress until the hand of time has marked the lapse of ages." Darwin certainly never saw evolution in action in the Galapagos Islands because he spent only 5 weeks there, 5 weeks in the fall of 1835. He arrived September 15th, 1835. He left late October, bound for Tahiti. And it was only after he got home that he began to realize that the variation he'd seen in birds, in iguanas, in tortoises, in cacti in the Galapagos Islands, might have had special significance. And in the book he wrote about his voyage around the world on the Beagle, Journal of Researches, now known as The Voyage of the Beagle, he wrote ruefully in his chapter about the islands, "It is the fate of most voyagers no sooner to discover what is most interesting in any locality then they are hurried from it." So Darwin spent a good part of his career reconstructing what he might have seen or what he might have been able to put together had he spent more time in the Galapagos Islands. And in The Origin of Species, he argues very logically and beautifully, you can still read the book with pleasure, that variation, the theme of our talk tonight, variation, is the cornerstone of all of the change that has produced the fabulous, fabulous variety we see around us in the Tree of Life. His first chapter, chapter one, is called Variation Under Domestication. And he begins with this very humble, very simple theme of variation, individual, minute variations, the kinds of individual variations that we see around the room right now. If we look around at each other's faces, we see variation. If you go to your family dinner table, you see variations. And if you look around at life in a barnyard, life in, if you look at a litter of puppies or a litter of kittens, you see variation, innumerable variations. And Darwin begins there. He talks about variations in wild duck bones, cow and goat udders, cats with blue eyes, hairless dogs, pigeons with shorter beaks, pigeons with longer beaks, variations everywhere. Body and instinct, also instinct varies. He talks about a dog in this first chapter whose great-grandfather was a wolf, and this dog showed a trace of his wild parentage only in one way, by not coming in a straight line to his master when called. Isn't that a great line? And he notes that many, if not most, of these variations, like that one in the dog, are inherited and are passed down, as, again, you see around you at the family dinner table. He didn't know how they were inherited and passed down, because he was living a century before Watson and Crick discovered the double helix, half a century before Thomas Morgan here at Columbia, Thomas Hunt Morgan, established the science of genetics in a laboratory in Skirmerhorn, which is only 2 minutes away from here. By the way, it was an undergraduate, 19 years old. I'm addressing this to the biologists of the collegiate school. A couple years older than you, decided that he could look at his professor's data. His professor was breeding fruit flies and looking at who got the white eyes, who got the red eyes. Some of you have been studying this. You've heard about it. Tracing the family tree through those white eyes, red eyes, ruby eyes, curly wings, bristly legs, a lot of variation even in fruit flies. He collects all of the data from the laboratory, or certain files of it. He takes it back to his dormitory room, 19 years old. He has homework. He decides he's not going to do the homework. Instead, he's going to look at all this variation and follow the family trees, and with a very brilliant puzzle-solving idea, which I can't go into now, but which was extraordinarily simple in retrospect, he could demonstrate not only that genes exist, that is, that all this variation that we see around us is encoded in bits, like mosaic tiles, but on the level of the genes, not only could he do that, he could map them. He could show where in the fly's chromosomes that gene for white eyes, for instance, was located, and where for curly wings. So he produced, by pulling that all-nighter, the proof that there could be a science of inheritance, a true science of genetics, as it came to be called, and that you could make a map of the genes, which now reached a climax just recently in our time with the Human Genome Project. So all that in one all-nighter. Well,
don't do your homework, collegiate school biologist.
Yeah, that's right. If you're struck by an inspiration like that, your teacher will forgive you. Morgan was so impressed that he made Sturtevant a professor, this is some years later, at Caltech when he moved on to the California Institute of Technology. And Sturtevant's remembered as one of the great biologists, along with Morgan, of the 20th century. So all of these instincts and little variations in the body, in even in personality, are potentially heritable. They're not all inherited, but Darwin argued many, many of them are inherited. And this very simple fact, again, is the cornerstone of his entire argument. He calls the origin of species one long argument, and this is where the argument begins. He was a brilliant writer and a brilliant, in a quiet way, a brilliant arguer, because he's starting with something that we do all know. I keep mentioning the family dinner table. You're always thinking about what did you get from your father, what did you get from your mother, what might you have gotten from your grandfather, your grandmother. This is something I see in my family. My kids are both gifted in mathematics, and I'm sorry to say they didn't get it from me. But they got it from my father, who used to teach here at Columbia, and he taught applied mathematics. Both my kids got those genes. I didn't get those genes. And Darwin had a grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, who believed that the logical explanation for the diversity of life on Earth was a kind of family tree, starting with a few very early, very simple forms of life, and gradually evolving, though he didn't use that word, evolving into the fantastically diverse family tree of species that we see around us now. Erasmus Darwin thought that. Darwin, that's two generations before Charles. But Erasmus wrote about it in a long, now unreadable poem called Zoonomia. And he had no explanation for what might have caused the branching of the tree. He only had the conviction that that might explain the diversity of life on Earth. And there were other people, too, who believed that without being able to explain the mechanism. So Charles, as he started thinking after the voyage of the Beagle about the specimens he had collected in his voyage around the world, and particularly the mockingbirds and the finches that he had found in the Galapagos and that some of his shipmates had found, as he started thinking about the importance of variation and making notes in a lot of secret notebooks, with secret written on the cover of these notebooks, he noted at one point, "My handwriting, same as grandfather." Which must have been an eerie moment for him, because he's thinking about the way small variations in behavior and personality are passed down. He's thinking, revisiting his grandfather's theory, and he's beginning to think he's going to devote his life to one long argument to prove that it's correct. And he's noticing that his handwriting is very much like his grandfather's. So, variations. The first point that Darwin makes about variations, beyond their existence, their pervasiveness, the universality of variation, is that they're inherited. The second point he makes is that they can be selected. He doesn't use the term, the famous term now, natural selection, yet in introducing this concept. He's talking, remember, about variation under domestication. So he talks about variation as it's visible to breeders, breeders of dogs, breeders of cats, breeders of corn. They all select among variations. If there weren't variations, there would be nothing for them to select. And he talks about unconscious selection. There are unconscious acts of selection when breeders choose their favorite pup in a litter or their favorite kitten and choose those to breed. And he also speaks of natural selection. There are all kinds of variations that are being selected in the wild or being selected just out there in the sheep pen, in the pasture, that the breeder himself isn't aware of. The breeder isn't following. So then he says, the same thing must be going on everywhere in nature. And that's chapter 2 of The Origin, Variation in Nature. That's a subject that fascinated Rosemary Grant of Princeton as a child. She grew up in a village in the Lake District, and at the age of 4, she used to follow the old family gardener around, and she noticed that in any row of vegetables, no two were exactly alike. And all the trees around their house, the birches, the oaks, the beeches, they were all different, one from the next. She knew she had her favorite trees. All of the people in the village, everybody was different, all those variations. And Darwin made a special study of variation in barnacles, and he spent years on it. So many years that a son of his grew up taking it for granted that every father studied barnacles. And he went over to his friend's house once, and he got a tour of the house, and he said to his friend, "And where does your father do his barnacles?" So, variation, it's inherited. It's in every garden plot. It's in every forest around the garden plot. It's on every desert island. And then think of the pressure out there. That's chapter 3, struggle for existence. That's what makes variation so significant, so charged with significance for Darwin in his argument. If animals and plants vary, the slightest difference, as Darwin writes in The Origin, the smallest grain in the balance, in the long run, must tell on which death shall fall and who shall survive. So there, you know, he's talking about the deer that can run a little faster than the other deer, the wolf that can run a little faster than the other wolves, and those deer. Anybody know the old joke about the camp and the bear? Campers and a bear hear a bear approaching. It'd be nice if they heard a bear approaching. But it's a bear, they hear a bear, and one of them starts putting on his running shoes. And the other one says, "Are you crazy? You can't outrun a bear." And he says, "I don't have to outrun a bear. I just have to outrun you." So there are situations, Darwin says, where the slightest variation is going to become a matter of life and death. Darwin himself couldn't see that happening, but he argued that it had to happen, that it was only logical to assume that it happened and happened everywhere. And he writes, "What applies to one animal will apply throughout time to all animals, that is, if they vary, for otherwise natural selection can do nothing." So again, given the assumption of variation, it's only logical to conclude that there will be times, given the pressure of the struggle for existence, the struggle to get enough food, the struggle to stay warm through the night, the struggle to find a mate in our time, among our kind. If we are fortunate, we're much less aware often of the struggle for existence. We're still aware, just as keenly as ever, of the struggle to find a mate. Selection pressure of one kind or another is intense. And in the wild, or among domestic species, and among our own species, it operates in every generation, and individual variations, slight variations, can make all of the difference in whether you pass on your genes or you don't get to pass on your genes. So that's Darwin's argument, as simple as that, in The Origin of Species. That's the essence of it. But in his gradualistic view of geological change and of evolutionary change, it all takes place at the level that mountains are built, that rivers wear away canyons. It's all too slow to watch. And that's how most of us still think of evolution today, I think. Certainly that's how I thought of evolution when I first heard about Peter and Rosemary's work, which is why I was so surprised. And I have to say, from the moment I heard that they go to the Galapagos and watch this, I was so enthralled that, again, I got completely caught up in telling people the story and continually forgot how controversial a story it is. And I still remember the first time that happened that I got sort of a wake-up call about the controversy was at a family dinner table, as a matter of fact. It was a party in Allentown, Pennsylvania. My family lived in Allentown at the time. And I was talking at the table about this wonderful new story that I was going to write a book about, the study of evolution in action. And afterwards, someone came up to me by the coat closet at the end of the party and said, "Excuse me, did I hear you say you were writing about evolution?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Are you for it or against it?"
And then a week later,
I was in the dentist's chair, and I was getting my teeth cleaned, and the dental hygienist, who was wearing one of those hygienic masks, and so was a little bit forbidding, but spoke through the mask and asked me, "What are you working on now? Did you find a new subject to write about?" And I said, "Yeah, evolution." And she bends really close to me, and she stares at me eyeballs to eyeballs, and she said, "Well, I'm a Jehovah's Witness, so you know what I think about that." And I didn't feel I was in any position to argue. And then I was finishing the book about the grants, The Beak of the Finch. I was finishing the book. I'd written the last chapter. I had pulled an all-nighter, not as earth-shattering as Alfred Sturdivant's all-nighter, but I was very proud of the results. I had a chapter, my last chapter, called God and the Galapagos, as a matter of fact, trapped in my computer. And my computer froze. A technical glitch. The computer froze. I couldn't print it out. I had to print out that chapter in time for the Federal Express drop-off. We didn't have email. This is early 1990s. I had to get it to the FedEx drop-off in my small town in Pennsylvania, and I couldn't print it out. So I called the local Apple store. By the way, talk about the importance of small variations. I hope everybody is an Apple fan here. And I called and I begged the guy who answered the phone. The place was already closed, but it was a technician, a tech repair guy. Would he let me in and would he save my chapter? And so he lets me into the store. I go in. Half an hour later, the computer is barfed all over the counter at Computer Forum in Doylestown. Now, he's got it under control. He's doing a beautiful job. I'm not too nervous. It's all going fine. And he looks up, and he says very sociably to me, you know, I'm sort of pacing around, and he says, "So what's your book about?" And I said, "Yeah, I still haven't heard." I said, "Evolution." And there's this awful silence again. And he says, "Well, I can tell you, and I have a PhD in engineering, and I know that this Earth was created, much as we see it now, within the last 5 or 6,000 years." So we just sort of look at each other, and I look down at the computer, barfed out on the counter, and out of wonderful charity in his heart, he just shrugs, and he goes back to work, and he saves the draft, and I printed it out, and the poor guy, I've told this story 12 zillion times since then, and I'm sure he's heard it himself once or twice. It was a very, very merciful act on his part. We agreed to disagree, and he saved the chapter. All right, so what is it that makes the grant study in the Galapagos so extraordinary? It's partly, I think, that Darwin himself didn't believe that you could see what they, in fact, can see, much as he intuited the importance of the islands. If you read The Voyage of the Beagle, which is terrific reading, it was a bestseller in his day. It was always his favorite book, by the way, much more important to him than The Origin, because it was his first and it was a bestseller. He says of the Galapagos, "Hence, both in space and time, we seem to be brought somewhat near to that great fact, that mystery of mysteries, the first appearance of new beings on this earth." But he's only collected a couple dozen finches, and he has no way of knowing that in the islands with the finches, you could demonstrate each of those simple steps that I just laid out, the steps in the origin, and you could show how vital variation is, and you could show it leading to evolution, not only within your lifetime, but within a single year. So this is what Peter and Rosemary found. They went to the Galapagos in 1973 for the first time. They pitched camp on this little desert island called Daphne Major in the middle of the archipelago, an island that's such a little speck of rock that Darwin himself never even saw it from the Beagle. They began studying Darwin's finches, and they assumed, as Darwin had assumed, that they would have to infer the evolutionary process from the variations that they were measuring in the birds. They didn't think they could see it themselves any more than Darwin ever thought in his lifetime he could see it. But they found from their first measurements that Darwin's finches are incredibly variable birds. As it happens, and Darwin himself couldn't know this, but as it happens, they're some of the most variable animals in the wild. I mean, it is bizarre how variable they are. Some of my students are here tonight. Actually, my entire seminar is here from the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, and I thank you all for coming. And now I just completely diverted myself from wherever I was going there. The incredible variation of the finches. They found that the beaks of the birds, for instance, vary by as much of as a millimeter within the population. So that sounds tiny to us, but we're talking about birds about the size of the sparrows of New York City. In fact, they look a little like the sparrows of New York City. And their beaks are far more variable than the beaks of the sparrows of New York City. Oh, I know where I was going. I have two excellent birders in my class who know more about this than I would know. So these birds are really variable. Variation is showcased by these birds. So if you're going to start with variation, then this is an amazing place to look for it in Darwin's finches. And the variations are inherited. So how did the Grants know that?
They had to go back to this desert island
again and again, year after year, and trace the birds.
Oh, thanks, Kendall.
They had to trace the birds' family trees. And that meant climbing up on boulders, lava boulders on this desert island, and peeking into the nests of the Opuntia cactus. The finches would build their nests high up in the cactus. And putting little bands, colored bands, on each baby finch and making careful notes so that they knew who its mama was, who its papa was, and doing that generation after generation. And you have to picture, I can't move away from this microphone or I would draw it somewhere. But the island is shaped, it's a cinder cone sticking up out of the Pacific, and it's as steep as a roof all the way around. So if you, the Grant students call it the biggest ashtray in the world. You know, if you picture a classic hotel ashtray just floating in the middle of the Pacific, you've got it. When one of their students, Lyle Gibbs, once climbed up to peek into a finch nest so that he could band the baby finches, he fell. He rolled down the island. Then he fell off the cliff because the volcano is surrounded by cliffs that the waves have worn away all around. He landed in the Pacific among the sharks because the island is surrounded by sharks. And then he had to swim halfway around the island. Oh, thanks a lot, Phil. All right. Apologies to those of you who are listening, and I'm going to draw a picture of this extraordinarily forbidding island. It's like a Jules Verne forbidding island. Might almost have inspired him.
So there's the Pacific, looking Pacific, looking peaceful. Here is Daphne Major, and the cliffs are like that all the way around.
Steep.
Very steep. Very steep. Steep as a roof.
All right. I don't know if that was worth the
the audiovisual effort.
But the point about the cliffs is important. If I were a better artist, you would get the feel for those cliffs, because the Pacific is usually not Pacific. In fact, Darwin, who was always seasick, complained about this in his letters home, miscalled Pacific, he said. the waves, if you are on a little Zodiac heading for this island because there's no place to dock, the waves are lifting you halfway to the ceiling and then dropping you down to the floor below us. And you have to time your jump from the Zodiac onto this little block of basalt that I call, ironically in the book, the welcome mat. The Grants do not call it the welcome mat. And then you have to climb up a trail, a very steep trail, to the cinder cone, to the one place that's flat enough and sandy enough to pitch a camp,
to pitch a tent.
And the Grants began doing this, as I say, in 1973, and brought their two little girls with them and raised these two little girls on Daphne Major and in several other islands in the Galapagos. And
they participated in the banding of the birds. And what the Grants were seeing was so exciting to them that they seemed to have focused almost exclusively on the beaks of the finches
and hardly ever on the faces of their little girls. I'm not saying they were badly brought up. They're very happy kids. They now have very happy families. But if you look at the slides of Peter and Rosemary Grant and their family, you see finches and finch beaks, variation from one finch to the next, and at the Grant's retirement party at Princeton last fall, about a year ago, Nicola Grant said that she was trying to find slides of the family on this desert island for the retirement occasion, and the closest she could come was a picture that showed her hand holding one of Darwin's finches.
That was it.
So that's why there are no photographs in the beak of the finch, actually. Anyway, they start watching Darwin's finches, documenting this variation from generation to generation, and they still don't believe that they're going to be able to see Darwin's argument in action until a drought year
came in 1977.
And in 1977, at the start of the year, there were 1,200 Geospiza fortis, which are medium-beak ground finches, on Daphne Major. And I'm rounding that number. The Grants have the exact number. And
of course, they know who those birds' parents and grandparents and great-grandparents were. At the start of the year, 1,200 fortis. By the end of the year, only 180 survived on Daphne Major, a loss of 85%.
Of the survivors,
it was not a random sample. Of the survivors, it was the bigger birds with the bigger beaks that made it through. Not longer beaks, not wider beaks. Selection favored
a deep and narrow beak among Geospiza fortis that year. And the reason was tribulus seeds. Tribulus, from tribulare, Latin for trouble. These are seeds with terrible spikes, terrible if your beak is measured in millimeters.
They're seeds that are encased in a thick coat and that have these spikes like caltrop. If anybody is a fan of medieval armor, you know caltrop. Those were the spiky, the ball with spikes that people would whirl around as a mace or that they would, yeah? That they would, I see some nods.
Some collegiate kids.
Yeah, that's right. These seeds, independently of
medieval knights, invented caltrop,
and they are the bane of the existence of most medium-beak ground finches on Daphne, except those lucky ones that happen to be born with a longish, narrowish, strong beak. Those are the only ones that are able to crack a tribulus seed because they can get their beak in between the spikes, and then they're strong enough to be able to crack the coat. So it's like the last pistachio nuts. As the drought is going on, everybody else has cracked all the easy seeds on the island. The last pistachio nuts, the one you need the nutcracker for at the bottom of the bowl, only those fortunate few with the right beak at the right time were able to get a meal by the end of that year. And that's why they were the ones that survived. Only 15 in 100. Well, among Geospes affortus, as among many animal species, the males tend to be bigger than the females. That's a phenomenon called sexual dimorphism, and evolutionary biologists study that, the reasons for it, why might it have evolved. It's a general rule among affortus. So the result is that at the end of the drought, there are many more males that have survived than females. In fact, 6 times more females have survived than males. That means that when the rains finally came at the end of that drought year, and the island suddenly turned green again, and the birds began to sing on the cactus trees, the males sing to attract the females, and then the females fly around and check them out, listen to the song, check out the height of the perch on the cactus tree, and apparently check out the beaks of the male birds, too. They had their pick. The females had their pick of the males because there were six times as many males as there were females. So that was an episode, of what Darwin called sexual selection. And sexual selection operated, again, with uncanny intensity at that moment among Darwin's finches. So you have birds that are remarkably variable, that have gone through a remarkably intense selection event, very, very tough drought, and are now the largest with just those beaks being selected with remarkable intensity by sexual selection and natural selection. They breed, they pass on their genes. The next generation is strikingly larger and has a striking number of these excellent tribulus cracking beaks all over Daphne Major. It's such a striking change that you can see it with the naked eye on Daphne Major from one year to the next, although, of course, the grants and their grad students and their students have collected all these numbers and crunched them in computers. They have supercomputers that can crunch the toughest. I'm making a little pun here, but I'm not going to pursue it. But they found that, in fact, they had seen evolution in action. And that is the theme of Chapter 4 of The Origin, Natural Selection or the Survival of the Fittest. The birds had undergone natural selection, survival of the fittest, then this bout of sexual selection. The variations had been inherited, and you had a striking evolutionary change. I'm happy to say that a few years later in 1983, and it was a Nino year, El Nino made the island incredibly wet, and suddenly, within a week, it was covered with grass. It rained so much that the birds bred and bred generation after generation. There were many generations within that one wet year, and the pressure is now reversed. And can anybody guess why they might have reversed during that wet year? They could eat other seeds. Good. That's right. And grass seeds, which had covered the lava, hid the tribulus seeds. So if you were a big-bodied bird with a big nutcracker beak, this is relatively speaking compared to all your neighbors and cousins, you couldn't get those tribulus seeds. And a big-bodied bird needs a lot more seeds to sustain it. The little guys who had the equipment to crack those little grass seeds were the ones who ate and ate and ate, and the big guys were at a disadvantage. And I, as not representing one of the big guys of my species, I'm always happy to say that the pendulum swung the other way. And now it was the little guys with those grass seed beaks that were favored by natural and sexual selection. And this little two-step that the birds had taken in one direction, they now reversed and danced in the other direction within a matter of a couple of years. So that's only one of hundreds, literally hundreds of episodes of evolution in action that the Grants and their students and now many other biologists are documenting in the islands. And they have demonstrated with fantastic precision that variation can be a matter of life and death, that the smallest grain in the balance really can determine who shall live and who shall die, and that it can produce evolutionary change. And if climate changed in a way that didn't swing back pendulum-like from one state to another, from wet to dry, if, for instance, one imagines these birds arriving in the Galapagos for the first time some millions of years ago, blown off course, perhaps in a Nino year from South America, blown way out to sea, landing in those islands, they arrived in a situation very different from the one in which their ancestors had lived and flourished. They were under selection pressure at least as great as those Fortis are on Daphne Major today in the swings of climate, only the climate didn't swing the way it's doing now. For them, conditions remained extremely severely different from the rainforest of Ecuador, what is now Ecuador, from South America, where they had, where their ancestors lived. In, I think, I hope I'm remembering this right, in a matter of 20 successive steps as large as that one that I just described in the drought of 77, you would have built a bird as different one from the next as the medium-beak ground finch to the large-beak ground finch on Daphne Major. You would have gone from one species to another. Or if the pressures were all the other way, you would have gone to the small-beak ground finch. There are now, from that ancestral colony, which consisted maybe of just one pregnant finch, we don't know, that would have done it. From that ancestral colony, there are a baker's dozen of species of Darwin's finches in the islands. So I'm trying to decide how much time we have and whether I can tell you a little more about the beauty of this variation. You can now go down to the level of the DNA with Darwin's finches, which you couldn't do when I was writing about Peter and Rosemary, to my sorrow. I hoped that I would be able to back in the early 90s, and the tools weren't really there yet. But a few years ago, Peter and Rosemary began collaborating with a group of molecular biologists at Harvard, led by Cliff Tabin. And they did the study that I dreamed that the Grants would do while I was writing about them. They looked at the level of the genes to trace the variation to the level of the genes and see what is being selected for at that ultimate level of variation. And they found a signaling molecule called bone morphogenetic protein 4.
Is that going to be on the test?
Yes, it is. BMP4, write it down.
Finches with bigger beaks tend to have more BMP4. And finches with smaller beaks have less BMP4. And in the lab, these biologists were able to demonstrate using chicken eggs, that they could sculpt the beaks themselves by adding or subtracting BMP4. There are other genes involved. There's a gene, there's a protein called calmodulin, a gene for that. There's something called, this won't be on the test except extra credit, tertiforin melanin cumosphorus. All of these genes sculpt the beaks of the finches, and the same genes sculpt the human face in the womb. So Darwin said in The Origin, light will be thrown on the origin of man and his history. We begin to see how our species could have evolved from a collection of perhaps dozens of close relatives in Africa, as close or closer than Darwin's finches are one to the next in the Galapagos Islands. You've heard about the recent discovery of Artie, Ardipithecus. She was a hominid who lived 4.4 million years ago in what's now Ethiopia. She was recognizably to us human-like. She was also recognizably what we think of as ape-like. She looks like something like a cross, say, between a chimpanzee and a human being. She weighed about 110 pounds, according to the paleontologist. She stood about 4 feet high. The family lines that evolved into modern humans and chimpanzees shared an ancestor 6 to 7 million years ago. And there are some hints of two splits between our lineages. According to the readings of the DNA and the reconstructions there, there was a split, an initial split, then there was interbreeding between the two populations, and then a second split. The grants are seeing that kind of splitting and then hybridization and fusing again and then splitting again among Darwin's finches. It's one of the most extraordinary aspects of their studies of the finches, and it may lie in the distant beginnings of our own family line. All that action took place in Africa at about the same time as it was taking place in this young candelabra of Darwin's finches, because the Galapagos Islands arose as volcanoes between 1 million and 9 million years ago. And the differences in DNA between human beings and our nearest relatives today, the chimpanzees, are about the same as the differences between a tree finch and a ground finch. Mm-hmm. Artie had a muzzle that was vaguely ape-like, but it didn't project quite as much as it does the muzzle in the faces of modern African apes. Her nose was pretty flat like theirs. It wasn't yet beaks like our human beaks. And that variation was shaped by BMP4. After Artie, there was another huge change as our brains expanded and expanded very dramatically. Molecular biologists are reading stories in the genes that govern that too. And Darwin himself recognized that characters, as he called them, aspects of a species that evolved relatively recently, tend to be more variable than others. So it's that recency that explains the variability of Darwin's finch beaks, and that explains the extraordinary variation of human brains from one to the next, and of minds even more than brains. I could go on a little bit more about that. Actually, let me just read you a little passage about that from the beak of the finch that explains it well, I think, 287.
Open your books, please.
Yeah. So he talks about this theme. I'm doing this because I saw some frowns. You were trying to grasp that point, which is a subtle one that he's making about extra variability in characters of recent origin. He develops this theme in the origin in a chapter titled Laws of Variation under the heading A Part Developed in Any Species in an Extraordinary Degree or Manner in Comparison with the Same Part in Allied Species Tends to be Highly Variable. And here Darwin cites the beaks of domestic pigeons when the beak is part of what distinguishes the breed. This pattern holds across nature. The beaks of Darwin's finches have turned out to be a particularly dramatic case. No other character in Darwin's finches is as variable as the beak. In our own species, it's the human brain that has diverged most dramatically from those of our nearest relatives on the tree of life. True to Darwin's law, the human brain is exceedingly variable in its measurements, like the beaks of Darwin's finches, pigeons, and crossbills. The volume of the human skull, its cranial capacity, is more variable than the depth of GSB's affortus beaks on Daphne Major. The mind is our beak, and the human mind is even more variable than the brain. And then I go on to talk about Darwin's own regrets about mathematics. He was lousy at mathematics, and he was brilliant at so many kinds of reasoning and lousy at mathematics. He's a hero to many of us for that. So that's one of the reasons that he was able to write a book like The Origin of Species, because he couldn't use mathematics well. So he puts it all into words, and he puts it all into words that anybody can understand and that still make good reading today. So Darwin, toward the end of The Origin, theorized, the chief cause of our natural unwillingness to admit that one species has given birth to clear and distinct species is that we are always slow in admitting great changes of which we do not see the steps. Today, we can see the steps. Darwin is alive and well and living in the Galapagos. And yet so many do close their minds to all this fabulous variation and fabulous adventure of selection, of struggle, and of success generation by generation. So why is that so hard to take? Why is this story so hard to take? That's a question I want to leave you with. It, to me, is one of the most beautiful stories in all of human culture. It's one of the great discoveries of science, certainly, and it's one of the great achievements of human beings that we have been able to reconstruct so much and see so much and discover it still in action now among us. I remember that line in The Voyage of the Beagle. It is the fate of most voyagers no sooner to discover what is most interesting in any locality than they are hurried from it. So how wonderful that our own kind has seen at least this much of our story, which must be the most interesting story on planet Earth. All right, thank you very much.